global warming, climate, and history.
With thousands of vessels operating in the Arctic waters, we are really entering a new era of environmental history in the Arctic.
A roundtable discussion on the role of climate change in the past, and an interview with Ross Cohen about his new book on the 1969 voyage of the SS Manhattan through the Northwest Passage. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 31 of Nature's Past, the first part of our special series, Histories of Canadian Environmental Issues.
Hi, I'm Stacey Nation Knapper. I'm a third-year doctoral student in the History Department at York University.
And I'm Andrew Watson, a sixth-year PhD candidate in the History Department at York University.
Well, thanks to the both of you for joining us for our first episode of our series on histories of Canadian environmental issues. And on this episode, we're dealing with probably the biggest issue facing Canadians today in terms of the relationship between people and non-human nature, and that is anthropogenic global climate change, the climate change induced by human activity. Over the summer, an article was published in Rolling Stone by Bill McKibben, a leading voice on global environmental issues, particularly global climate change, called Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. Can you two tell us a little bit about what McKibben wrote in this article? Because I think it sets the stage for the issue at hand.
Sure. So McKibben is essentially recounting some of the extreme weather events and extreme climate changes that we've seen this summer, including wildfires, record high temperatures across the globe. And he's also talking about the lack of attendance at climate conferences around the world by political leaders. And he's arguing in this piece that humans are losing the climate debate or the fight against climate change because we're in denial about it.
That's right. The last climate conference this summer, neither the Prime Minister from Canada nor the President of the United States attended that conference.
Right.
I think he's also recognizing that the debate is really not necessarily the point anymore, too. He's really, in this article, trying to dumb down the discussion to three numbers here. Three numbers he's got. This is his terrifying new math, right? Is the first point is that 2 degrees Celsius of warming, more than what we have already warmed up the planet, which is 0.8% Celsius warming globally, 2% more will be catastrophic for the entire planet's climate.
This is an average increase of global climate by 2%. That's his first number.
Right.
Okay.
And his second number is 565 gigatons of carbon, which he says is what we've put into the atmosphere since industrialization began, and this has pushed us, 565 gigatons has already pushed us up 0.8% or 0.8 degrees Celsius as a global average. And his third number is 2,795
right.
gigatons. Mm-hmm. And this, in some ways, is the most alarming, I think, for McKibben. And it represents the number, the amount of carbon, 2,795 gigatons of carbon left in proven reserves of fossil fuels.
So the possible greenhouse gas emissions that could be emitted and potentially are targeted to be emitted because it's our knowable reserves of coal, oil, and gas.
Right. And just as a point of clarification, I want to make sure that I understood on the 565 gigatons of carbon dioxide, I understood that that was our budget to get us to that 2%.
Right.
Should we
That's
hit
right, yeah.
that point, that is what's estimated to bring us to that 2%, or I'm sorry, that 2 degrees
2
Celsius.
Degrees Celsius. Right.
Though something that McKibben addresses in this article is that that's really not taking into account the fact that these greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere continue to warm over time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's even a bit of a conservative.
So 2 degrees Celsius doesn't sound like a lot to me. It's 20 degrees out today, but 22 sounds like it'd be nice. Why is 2 degrees Celsius in average global climate different than 2 degrees Celsius in your daily temperature? What does McKibben say about this? I mean, he says this is significant.
Well, if it's a global average, he's looking at the climate change at the equator plus the climate change at the poles and then averaged. So you're going to have a lot more change happening in the Arctic in the Antarctic, in the poles, than you will at the equator. And when you average these things out, the average temperature change is 2 degrees, right? Mm-hmm. And in the Arctic, it'll be a lot more. And at the equator, it will be quite a bit less.
And as well, 2 degrees Celsius increase isn't, so following what Andrew was saying, it's not a blanket increase in temperature.
Right.
So not only is it an increase of this kind of homogenized number, mm-hmm. it's increasing more in some places, not as much in others, but the weather patterns that will change. And as McKibben refers to in the article, the droughts and the floods and whatnot that can follow on the heels of mm-hmm. an increase of this amount are much more catastrophic than the idea of, oh, the weather's going, or the temperature's going to go up by 2 degrees.
So McKibben's article is pretty alarming.
Right.
But of course, he's not the first person to bring this to public attention. And climate change, of course, isn't a new issue. And I guess that's why we're here, to talk about the history of climate change. So Stacey, give us a little bit of sense of the issue of climate change and its recent history.
Sure. Well, I think it's been interesting to watch historically the conversation of climate change transition from a conversation that predominantly happened within the scientific community and started as early as the mid-19th century, mm-hmm. following on the heels of the Industrial Revolution, and people noticed changes in the atmosphere, and scientists began calculating how those changes affected the global climate. And I think the first paper published was in about 1896 on this topic. But the conversation really remained in the scientific community until the 1960s. And that's when mm-hmm. a lot of scientists started to feel it was important to bring this to the attention of policymakers, which of course then brought this conversation into the public realm. And once that happened, the topic of economics and how some of the policies that were being suggested to curb increases in greenhouse gases were going to economically affect individuals, businesses, corporations, and countries. And so it's evolved over time as far as which communities are involved in the debate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this really resonates, I think, in Canada as a historic environmental issue. Canada is increasingly becoming a petro state. Our dollar is so strong these days, mainly because of the tar sands economy.
So our economy is becoming much more linked to carbon.
Right. So the debates in Canada, I think, are really quite dynamic in terms of measuring out or weighing out the economic benefits against some of the environmental problems, climate change being the most important, I think, of the implications of pursuing a sort mm-hmm. of a petro-state politics.
And in terms of future prospects, if we know that climate change has been occurring as a result of human activity, and noticeable at least since the end of the 19th century, right up into the present, what are our options for the future in terms of adaptation? And I think this gets a really important question that we were talking about off the air, about how do we tell a story about the history of climate change? Is this always going to be a story of decline?
Well, I think from some perspectives, it's not being told as a story of decline. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the National Roundtable on the Environment or the Economy and the Environment published a report in which their kind of catchphrase was adapt and prosper. So this idea that climate change is an event from which Canadians can prosper. So mm-hmm. look for the opportunities that climate change presents to Canadians to further their economic well-being, their desire to grow economically.
And how much of this this perspective is kind of a bit of a smokescreen or a distraction, trying to suggest to Canadians that economic well-being is one way to support something like the tar sands and mm-hmm. ignore some of the increasingly sort of high tension and severe repercussions mm-hmm. of climate change that we are going to incur by continually pursuing an economic model that's based on fossil fuels. So I think it's interesting because real in the short term, perhaps, Canadians are going to be able to see tangible benefits from pursuing mm-hmm. fossil fuel economy. But in the long term, you know, in a generation or two down the road, those benefits will be be sort of not nearly as important mm-hmm. as the environmental fallout and some of the economic costs that climate change is going to incur.
And these issues are especially important for Canada's northern environments, which are experiencing climate change at an accelerated rate relative to southern latitudes, and particularly questions about shipping and transportation in the Arctic archipelago as 12-month sea ice cover becomes a thing of the past, and navigable channels and a navigable north in terms of ocean shipping becomes a reality. So, as we'll do with each of these issues, we're going to talk to some historians, get a little bit of context, and try to understand perhaps even how past human societies have adapted to climate change.
My name is Jim Daschak. I'm an assistant professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology and Health Studies at University of Regina.
I'm Josh McFadgen. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Western University and project coordinator for NISH just starting this fall.
And I'm Dagmar. I'm a PhD candidate at York University.
Well, I want to welcome the three of you to the podcast and to our conversation about the role of climate in history. And I thought a good way for us to get started might be to ask each of you what ways climate influences your own historical research. And maybe we'll start with Dagmar, working in chronological order here.
Sure, yeah. First, a little background. The Little Ice Age was a period of global climatic variability between the end of the 13th century and the middle of the 19th century. In much of northern Europe, three roughly 70-year periods of cold temperatures, increased storminess, and heightened precipitation were separated by decades of warmer and drier, more tranquil weather. So the first element of my research contributes to the reconstruction of the relationship between climate and daily weather in the early modern Low Countries. Now, many scholars have argued that during the Little Ice Age, cold and wet, stormy weather worsened life for most people while harming the European economy. On the other hand, periods of moderate warmth, like those experienced in the high medieval centuries, are frequently seen as beneficial. So that only makes sense if you ignore the dynamic expansion of the larger capitalist Dutch economy, just as the Little Ice Age entered its coldest phase. So I'm exploring how the foundations of Dutch prosperity at sea and on land adapted to weather experienced during warmer and cooler decades.
And Josh, where does your research intersect with climate?
Well, first, I'd probably say and argue that everybody's research intersects with climate, right? And climate influences everyone's research and historically, and so it's just about a matter of how much and a matter of degrees. So I think mine is particularly influenced by climate because I look at agroecosystems. And I'm sort of mostly limited to Canadian research, a little bit of transnational research in the northern Great Plains and prairies, and in central Canada as well. But I look mostly at the Canadian story. And I started my research and my PhD research by studying flax. And in this particular commodity, kind of made a big appearance on the Canadian stage in the early 20th century. Now, there's always been flax grown, and there's still flax grown, and Canada's still a major producer, but it was grown especially in the early 20th century, and Canada became a major producer. And the rhetoric of the time was that the crop was grown as a sod-busting crop, and it was the first crop on new land. And it was always kind of connected to the frontier. And so it was, this pioneer crop was always in places where new land was being broken. And so I tried sort of a systematic study of this using census data. And what I found was that this was true, that actually there was a correlation between the location of flax production and the center of flax production and the location of the frontier in any given census year, especially in this period. But what I found later was that climate was really one of the main actors in this story because flax was selected in the northern climates because of its short growing season. And so it was a crop that you could break new land in the spring, get the seed in, and then have it mature more quickly enough in the fall to get a harvest. And so it was a climate story in that sense, that it was particularly well suited to the Canadian climate. And of course, we all know the story of Marquee wheat, which Charles Saunders helped develop with the Central Experimental Farm. And Marquee wheat was also in the same period. I should have mentioned this is sort of a 1900 to 1915 story. It correlates nicely with the Canadian, the settlement of the Canadian Plains, and the resettlement, you should say. And the Marquee wheat arguably becomes even more important because it's a new variety that's discovered and developed that allows farmers to get more crops out and in the northern climates, because it's an early maturing and this short growing crop. Mm-hmm. So that's the Western story. And then I've also looked at sort of agri systems, and Sean just heard a talk I gave on farming in the Maritimes. And I argue that in the Maritimes, ice is essential to farming, because in lots of the estuaries and lots of places where farmers are close to water, they in the wintertime, there was maybe 3 to 6 weeks where the ice was frozen thick enough for farmers to get out and dig through the ice and pull out sea manure. So this was often called mussel mud. And so this was extracted from the water, from the estuaries, dug out, and the ice was essential for this, because otherwise you could never get out there. Canoes were too, you know, small and difficult to maneuver. So the farmers are involved, really are interested in a great deal in climate, because they need to know exactly when the right time to get out on the water is. And so I argue that farmers kind of knew their weather systems, but also knew their marine environments just as well as they knew the uplands. And so climate for both of those stories is just critical. And I don't consider myself a climate history expert, but I do need to know enough about it and I need to know about adaptation, and we can maybe talk about adaptation later, because that's sort of where I'm going with this research, and how farmers adapt to new climates.
Absolutely. I want to come back to that. But before we do, Jim, could you let listeners know where climate intersects with your research?
Sure. I guess my work might actually function as a bookend to Dagmar's work on Little Ice Age in Europe. About 7 or 8 years ago, I was brought onto an interdisciplinary team, mostly economists and hard scientist geographers, looking, and they asked me to reconstruct climate drivers for the Canadian prairies. The Canadian prairies obviously are vulnerable to drought, and that's what they were really interested in. So I spent a few months going through the scientific literature looking for climate reconstructions. Mm-hmm. Then they also wanted to know, that first question was, people were adapting to what? The second question they asked me was, who was doing the adapting? I went through the archaeological and early historical literature to find out which First Nations groups were changing their adaptations, how they were moving around. Actually, there was an awful lot of movement. And the third question they asked me was, how did that adaptation occur? So what I did was I looked at cultural changes and geographical spatial changes with regard, basically in response to climate change from probably 1,000 years ago up to the 18th century.
Well, that's a good place to begin then. We've got a bit of a sense of where climate interacts with each of your research, but let's get back to something that Josh brought up. Josh, you suggested climate influences all history. Do you all agree with that?
Yeah, well, that's if I can sort of jump in. One thing I think is important is that we need to make a distinction between climate and climate change. Mm-hmm. Is, of course, the sum of weather events at a particular time and in a particular place. So, you know, the arid climate of, for example, much of the American Southwest has been central to the character of that region's development. And that's, of course, the topic of Rivers of Empire by Don Worster. But climate change is a different story. It's a story of how the sum of those weather events comes to shift. And it's a complex story. Many climatic fluctuations are either not global in scale or they're expressed differently in different regions. Massive worldwide climatic shifts, like the onset or conclusion of the Great Ice Ages and today's global warming, are rare. And even these huge changes have different impacts in different places. So I think it's important that we really think that and remember that climate and climate change are two very, very different things.
Okay.
Now, Josh, you brought up this point, but could you elaborate a little bit more on why you think climate is so significant to understanding history? It seems self-evident to environmental historians, but to a broader community of historians, climate hasn't always been the central part of the stories we tell about the past.
Well, it's maybe a bit whimsical, but you can think that climate's critical to everything from disease control and migration to like agro-ecosystems, as I was saying, to the number of ideal golf days on in given Canadian city. So, I mean, it's just kind of, it really has a all-encompassing effect on Canadian environment. So it could be related to crime, right? You can draw all sorts of, I know some climatologists who make this argument, right? That show me a problem and I'll show you how it's related to climate. That's kind of where I was going with that.
But that's a tricky thing too, right? Because climate is only just one influence among many. And,
right. Yeah.
You know, it's very difficult, you know, at times to read, you know, scientific papers or something that say that that climate will cause something to happen. And we always have to remember as historians that there are many different influences, and especially when we talk about cultural changes, you know, it's very difficult to see exactly how the climatic shift actually has a cultural influence. You have to be very, very cautious in saying those types of things. So, but yeah, of course, climate does have some sort of influence about every aspect of human history.
So, Jim, where do you see the significance of climate and climate change to understanding Canadian history or North American history?
Well, I totally agree that to environmental historians that climate and its corollary, I guess, climate change, are self-evident to us. But I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but when I've spoken about climate to more mainstream historians, I invariably get a question about, isn't that environmental determinism? And then I have to explain that climate basically opens up a series of possibilities. Climate change is, I guess, changing those possibilities. But I find when I give a mainstream audience a talk with climate as a central theme, I always have to explain that people get to make choices within the parameters set by climate rather than climate being the only determinant. And I find that's something that I have to keep pressing play on whenever I give a talk to mainstream historians. I know that with environmental historians, we're kind of singing to the choir or whatever.
Mm. Yeah. Josh and Dagmar, have either of you encountered that? The reticence on the part of other historians to talk about climate as an influencing factor because of the potential to slip into arguments about environmental determinism?
Yeah, I mean, I just did an interview the other day for Environmental Resource, another website, and one of the questions was, how do you guard against that sort of determinism? And it really does come up pretty much all the time, like when I give these talks or conferences, anything like that. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that, too. Part of it comes from the sciences, because there's constantly articles that say, you know, in the future, global warming will cause something to happen, and articles that say, in the past, climate change, say, has made wars more common during the Little Ice Age. Mm-hmm. But there's also sort of, you know, a real legacy here that's taken decades to sort of get past through the work of Christian Pfister and other historical climatologists. Mm-hmm. In the 1920s and, you know, 50s and beyond, there were a lot of these climatically deterministic narratives that tried to reinterpret history. And they've done a lot of damage, I think, to the field. So, yeah, there's still that notion that anytime you talk about climate, you know, you're being a bit deterministic. And that's something you have to fight all the time.
Well, this is interesting, right? So how do each of you deal with this in your analyses of the role of climate and analyses of the role of climate change and the influences that it may have on human societies? How do you overcome the challenge of the accusations that you might be being too determinative in your analysis of the role of climate?
If I can butt in here, mm-hmm. one of the things I try to do is to talk about the possibilities. I live on the Northern Great Plains, and you probably... Well, we're basically on the edge of where corn agriculture is possible. So if we go a little further north, a little colder environment, it's not possible. So the choices people have made in the past and continue to make in the present are determined by, I don't know, our environment, which is basically driven by climate. So it's what our options are, what our realistic options are.
And Josh, how about you and your work? How do you approach that challenge of environmental determinism?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit different in my work because I don't really explicitly say that that I'm studying the climate of the Great Plains or the prairies, right? I say that I'm studying people and how they adapt to all sorts of environmental challenges and how and so climate is really just one of them. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I've never really had to defend specifically about climate. Certainly environmental determinism comes up in almost all of our research mm-hmm. projects, right? And so, you know, we have to be able to point to actors and point to real examples in our research of how people are making decisions based on a variety of factors.
Now, the reason we're talking about climate on this episode of the podcast, of course, is we're concerned with contemporary challenges associated with anthropogenic or human-induced climate change. But, of course, as you as historians know, that climate has changed in the past, going back very far into the deep past, into the multiple millions of years. And so one thing I think history might be able to help us with understanding what we might be confronting in the present and into the future is to give us a bit of a sense of how human societies have adapted to climate change. So maybe we might start with Dagmar, if you can give us a couple of examples in your own work where you've seen human adaptations to a changing climate.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, like one of the big things that I look at is ship logbooks. Right? I look at the Dutch East India Company, and it's fascinating to see how these ships change over time. Mm-hmm. One of the big changes that was kind of affected by the Little Ice Age were shifts in direction of wind, especially in the northeastern Atlantic. And I look at ship journeys that were taking place through these shifting wind patterns. And, you know, you see a lot of, I guess, concern about the speed of ships when the wind patterns shift mm-hmm. on the part of the leaders of the Dutch East India Company. And I mean, it's interesting to see because these wind patterns, they can affect the speed of the ship journey, you know, quite a bit. You know, there's several weeks that are knocked off the time that the ship might take to get to the Indies. So, I mean, that's, I guess, kind of a starting point for where my research is going right now.
And Jim, can you give us some examples of what history might tell us about human adaptations to climate change?
Sure. I've done some research on indigenous societies in late prehistory in relation to climate change. I'd just mm-hmm. like to bring up sort of a contrast. The woodland people whose sort of metropolis was Cahokia, the largest city in North America until Philadelphia surpassed it in 1800. 20,000 people in an urban environment, mm-hmm. true city. Okay. By when the climate changed sometime in the middle of the 13th century, the city started to break down. By the middle of the 14th or 15th century, the city was basically abandoned. People probably hadn't adapted to the changes in climate, and not only the city broke down and was abandoned, but their hinterland was broke down and abandoned as well. Just in contrast to that, at about the same time, the Iroquoian-speaking people of New York State, Southern Ontario, went through a similar, really, two centuries of very hard times, inter-village conflict and whatnot. By the 15th century, one of their adaptations, and I've argued to climate change, or to the hardship imposed by the new climate regime, was that they set up something that's been known as the League of the Iroquois, a very sophisticated political and diplomatic set of relations that have succeeded for 500 years. So in one sense, the Cahokians and the woodland people didn't adapt in a positive way to the climate change, and they've sort of disappeared or had to move, whereas the Iroquoian-speaking people did adapt in a very successful way, and those institutions have continued for 500 years.
And Josh, in your work on the mussel mud, I mean, I recall you showed us an image of these farmers out on the ice with machinery digging up this mud from the bottom of these estuaries. To what extent is that itself an adaptation to a particular kind of climate change or a different kind of climate in the past than perhaps we might recognize in the present? Because certainly that kind of ice formation isn't as common anymore in the first decade of the 21st century, or is it?
Yeah, well, it's kind of what I was going to make a case for is that pre-anthropogenic climate change is really kind of not severe enough to make much of an impact on my subjects that I research. So, but what I do kind of get from my research is that it's in maybe some ways an active history or a public history, an application for history, where we can take examples of how people have adapted to climate, not necessarily climate change, but changing climates because of their migration, because of movement to a new place like the prairies or in settlement in the Maritimes. Mm-hmm. So the mussel mud digging one example is interesting because it was something made possible by a climate that just doesn't exist anymore. You couldn't get out on the ice and do that kind of activity now if you wanted to. It's just there's not enough ice in almost any part of the Northumberland Strait, and the Northumberland Strait hasn't in recent years froze over nearly as much as these farmers were recording in the estuaries around the Northumberland Strait. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's maybe not as applicable for me, but it gives an interesting sort of future forward-looking direction for our historical research and what can we learn about changing climate. What can we learn from historical examples?
Yeah, that's actually one thing I wanted to stress. Just going back a little bit, is the importance of environmental changes that might seem marginal, at least to people who aren't used to this kind of research. I mean, you indicated that. Climate shifts of the past weren't really important enough to have an influence on what she studied. And I've had people who work for Environment Canada approach me to say that the kind of climatic fluctuations we're talking about, parts of the Little Ice Age in Europe, weren't serious enough to really affect daily life. But in Europe, a shift in average temperature of not even 2 degrees Celsius was sufficient to reduce the growing season by about 6 weeks for most crops. And, of course, that had enormous ramifications for farmers and the people who depended on their crops. So when we study climatic fluctuation during most of human history, we're really talking about superficially insignificant changes that, like butterfly effects, actually had critical influences on humans and their local environments. Maybe not in the case of what you researched, but definitely for the Dutch Republic in my period.
That's a really interesting point, too, Dagmar, because I'm thinking about these case studies that each of you are referencing and thinking about whether or not the adaptations that we look at in the past, and especially into the deep past, are responses to subtle, broad-scale, gradual change.
Mm.
I don't know, Jim, if your case studies are dealing with very rapid climate change, or is this climate change over multiple human generations?
I actually think that there was a rapid amount or a very abrupt climate change sometime in the mid-13th century, and archaeologically, things started to happen. There was almost like a domino effect of cultures moving, and they moved west into the prairies into a drier environment as the old, their traditional communities in the woodlands were no longer sustainable. So I actually think that a lot of these things happened probably over a course of maybe 50, 60 years. Long-term trends, like I said, Cahokia was probably abandoned completely within 100 years of climate change or of that that big, abrupt climate change. But I think, actually, that there are very swift changes that we have been able to track archaeologically or historically.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would like to point out that historically, climatic variability has frequently been more destructive, more impactful than gradual warming or cooling. So, like in my case, I do study very rapid sort of climate shifts, the period of years or decades. Mm-hmm. And I want to stress, as long as that warming or cooling falls inside of a certain range, right? So in early modern Europe, for example, farmers could adapt to different decade-scale climates by changing their crops. But radical fluctuations in weather from year to year, almost always devastating. And that's when they'll usually find some of the worst famines. And it all ties into different patterns of vulnerability too. Mm-hmm. Different societies have different sources of vulnerability. So a society that's very dependent on a single kind of environmental resource from a defined geographic location would be more vulnerable, say, than the Dutch Republic, which was insulated from regional famine because of imported grain from across Europe. So I think most of the time, historians of climate look at short-term changes in climate because they have the biggest human impact, or at least the most easily identifiable human impact.
Well, this brings me a little bit closer to the present, I guess, in my thinking about this problem, though still thinking historically, but if we have evidence of anthropogenic climate change over at least the past 60 years or more in the North American context, or we can even think about this globally, do you think that this might in the future change the way historians think about the 20th century?
I would just like to say that once anthropogenic climate change has been recognized by everyone, there will be a growth industry of historians looking at the decisions of our political and economic leaders and like just deciding where we, you know, where the tipping point was, where we drove off the cliff. Because it just seems like, you know what I mean? Like there are so many political decisions that have been made that have ignored this and continue to ignore it that, I don't know, it's going to be a field day, sadly.
Josh, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm just going to follow on that. Do you think there will really, people will see the need to sort of identify a moment in time? Like, and there'll be a sort of a need for consensus on that?
There'll be an industry in it, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
I do wonder, though, that, you know, in my Canadian History Survey class, I show climate data for the 20th century, global climate data, and then Canadian climate data for the 20th century, and there's the observable sort of hockey stick as Canadian climate and global climate increases, which is very observable by at least the mid-1970s. And so I asked my students, will we ever look back on the history of the 1970s, the 1980s, and the 1990s, and, you know, a generation from now think that climate is the major story of 20th century, or at least post-war Canadian history?
Oh, I think that's entirely possible. You guys might be from another generation. I still watched the national news last night. There was a report on the national about the polar ice cap shrinking to its smallest size ever recorded by a lot. And you know, having the ice sheet in the Arctic that much smaller will only increase the amount of heat absorption in the Arctic Ocean, which will increase the whole process. And Peter Mansbridge actually asked Bob McDonald, the science columnist, so is the North as we've known it, like, is it done? Like, are we done with the North? So just a comment, like, that really struck me that there was a conversation on, you know, Canadian media, mostly for old-timers who still watch TV, but like that statement was even made kind of blew me away because they've, like, you know, it's beyond a doubt.
Right, yeah.
And sort of the political reporter was, you know, the federal government does not dispute the findings. They just dispute the causes.
Yeah.
I see possibly two roles for environmental historians in this new environment. And one is to follow up on what Jim was saying, to advise governments and to advise the public on what happened and how policy relates to that. And I think of the book that was written for based on a conference in 1955, Man's Role in Changing the Face of the Earth. If you remember that book, but it's in that book, and then the subsequent conference that was, I think, held in the 80s, there was some predictions made. And it's and we're coming up on a 50-year anniversary of that event, and their predictions were looking toward 2015, saying you know, CFCs will be banned, CO2 it will have risen to 375 parts per million, and just kind of comparing what they predicted at that conference and in those papers, we are currently at, I think, 395 parts per million. And of course, CFC, there's been all of the sort of historical events since that time have kind of come true in a lot of ways. And so it's a really interesting kind of example of how we can look at the historical record and say, this is what science was saying, and this is what policies were made or not made since then, and here's the trajectory we followed. That's the first thing. Second thing was kind of maybe what I like to do with my research is to point out that as environmental historians, our subjects were so much more attuned to the climate and to weather and to meteorological change than we are today, right? And I think that's the case for all three of our projects. But the farm diaries that I read, and Lisa Piper, her work's inspirational in this, but you just read how important and how central a recording and a reporting of the environment was, of the weather was. And so I've created this website called Real-Time Farming, and it just, it tweets the everyday observations of farmers, and which was really, it's kind of often turns into a tweeting the weather in the 19th century. And so day by day, people are paying attention to what's around them, and they're noticing the depth of snow, the temperature if they have a thermometer, but also and they're just the thickness of ice when it comes to, say, digging mussel mud or to crossing and traveling the ice. And so when you compare that to our world in real time, you say two conclusions, based in at least the region I study in Prince Edward Island. The climate then is much different than the climate now. So you look at the Twitter feed and say, you know, 6 feet of snow outside and there's either nothing or, you know, just very, very little snow left at that time in our modern age. And you just get to compare in real time, both seeing that people were more aware of their environment and they needed to know this information. It was a life and death information in lots of ways. And also just a direct comparison to what we live in now, which is a just it's the alien, it would have seemed like an alien environment to them. But yeah, just some of the ways environmental historians can share what we do.
Yeah, Dan, go ahead. Touch on a couple of those points, actually, because I'm in a process of writing a little blog article for Active History, where I look at the past to sort of find out why, say, these topless pictures of Kate Middleton have generated more attention than our increasingly topless planet. And and one of the things that I'm looking at is sort of the difference between attitudes in the 17th century between, say, urban Dutchmen and rural Dutchmen, or Dutchmen who are at sea on ships. And it's striking because, you know, you look at these ship logbooks, of course, I mean, they have to take down weather. But, you know, a lot of their sort of musings also involve the weather and how it's changing. And you look at, you know, records left by farmers, and they're constantly talking about weather. Pretty much every day they have something to say about weather. But then urbanites are much more focused on taxes and debt and, you know, things like that. And today we've really insulated ourselves, at least many of us in cities, we've insulated ourselves from the things that make life possible on Earth, right? I mean, how many of us go out to farms now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many of us have experience of the wilderness on a regular basis? So, you know, it's kind of interesting to see that parallel. But going back a little bit, when you're talking about the present and the future, when we as historians talk about global warming, mm-hmm. it's important for us to realize that our conclusions and our research can be co-opted by climate deniers. And this has happened to me, you know, a couple of times at conferences where I finish giving a talk and someone asks, well, you know, so climate has shifted in the past. Well, you know, and people did fine. Now, what does that say about our future, right?
Yeah.
Will we be okay, essentially? And, you know, we have to realize that our work is political and that we have an increasingly important voice, I think, especially now with, you know, the tools of the internet,
mm-hmm.
where we have a responsibility, really, you know, social responsibility to get the truth, I guess, out there.
And that's a little bit of the point of the series we're doing here, too. Certainly, you as historians are giving us context for how humans have reacted to climate change in the past. But in addition to giving us examples of human activity in the past to explain how to understand our relationship to the environment in the present, I think history tells us what's new. It can help explain what's novel about anthropogenic climate change in 2012 compared to climate change in the 13th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
and I actually want to mention one other thing, too.
Sure.
And that's what's really interesting to me when we look at the 20th century and the history of the 20th century and how climate has shifted
mm-hmm.
is the study of how similar weather events are differently understood in different cultures and by different people. It's actually a recent article that I came across which explored how warm weather is perceived differently according to your political orientation. So I may find a heat wave outrageously hot if I believe in global warming. But if I don't, I might not feel or at least remember that heat wave in the same way. So that's, you know, I think that has some interesting relevance to what's going on right now, in the States especially.
Well, unfortunately, I think we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. But as we almost always find with these roundtables, we just begin to scratch the surface and hopefully it starts the conversation for our listeners to think about climate change and history. Jim, Josh, and Dagmar, I want to thank each of you for joining us here.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sean. One thing I can add is that the climate is such a complex system that we really need to work together to understand it. And so I think having a round table is fitting to bring in multiple voices, you know. So,
or at least a virtual round table.
That's right. Yeah.
As we mentioned at the top of the episode, global warming has been a particularly pertinent issue in the Canadian North, a region of the country that has experienced accelerated rates of warming relative to the south. One of the major consequences of this warming trend has been a decline of sea ice cover in Canada's Arctic archipelago. The U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center recently reported a record low in Arctic sea ice for 2012, smashing all previous records. Scientists now predict that there could be an ice-free Arctic by the summer of 2015. To learn more about the significance of this environmental change, we spoke with Ross Cohen, author of the recently published book Breaking Ice for Arctic Oil, The Epic Voyage of the SS Manhattan Through the Northwest Passage.
My name is Ross Cohen, and I'm a PhD student in history at the University of Washington.
Ross, thanks for joining us on the podcast. We're here today to talk about your book, Breaking Ice for Arctic Oil, The Epic Voyage of the SS Manhattan Through the Northwest Passage. And I thought maybe we could get our listeners up to speed on just what the SS Manhattan was and what its historical significance was.
The SS Manhattan was a commercial tanker built in 1962 in Quincy, Massachusetts. She was the largest tanker in history at that time, nearly 1,000 feet long, measuring about 105,000 deadweight tons, a supertanker really before the era of supertankers. And then in 1969, Exxon chartered the vessel for an expedition through the Northwest Passage to test the economic and logistical feasibility of transporting Arctic resources via circumpolar marine routes. So in a nutshell, that's the Manhattan and what she accomplished.
Now, I think readers really need to go and look up some pictures of the Manhattan to really get a sense of the scale here. It's almost unimaginable to believe that there are supertankers larger than this vessel today.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. The Manhattan was actually constructed by the Nearcos Shipping Company in Greece. She was an American flag tanker, and she was built largely as a sort of a tax gimmick. The Nearcos subsidiary had seven smaller tankers that they wanted to withdraw from U.S. registry and then sail under flags of foreign states with more favorable taxation regimes. Mm-hmm. Well, the Jones Act stipulated that the Nearcos Shipping Company had to replace the withdrawn cargo capacity with ships of equal cargo capacity. They theorized that it would be easier to build one enormous tanker than another seven smaller ones, and that's how you end up with a 1,000-foot-long ship, something that had never been built before at that time.
It's amazing. Now, of course, the story that you tell in this book ties in very directly with what we're talking about on this episode of the podcast. We're looking at climate and history and climate change in history. And, of course, the Manhattan is probably most famously known for its 1969 voyage through the Northwest Passage, which is mostly what your book talks about. So could you explain for listeners why it is that Humble Oil sponsored and supported the Manhattan's expedition through the Northwest Passage? What was the purpose of this expedition?
Sure. So in 1968, upon discovery of the Prudhoe Bay oil field, this is on Alaska's North Slope. It's North America's largest oil reservoir at an estimated 15 to 20 billion barrels of crude oil. The three companies who made that discovery, British Petroleum, ARCO, and Humble Oil, which is a company that a few years later would change its name to Exxon, They sat atop the Prudhoe Bay oil field on Alaska's North Slope and looked at transportation methods for bringing that crude oil to market, primarily to the lower 48, California especially. And, of course, a pipeline was the first transportation option that was considered, and within weeks of the strike, those companies began doing aerial and ground surveys for a pipeline route south from Prudhoe Bay to somewhere on the southern coast of Alaska, Valdez, for example, where the oil would be loaded onto conventional tankers and taken down to the west coast of the United States. Now, that's, of course, the transportation option that was ultimately constructed and has been in continuous operation since 1977. But back to 1968, Humble Oil, again, this is the company that would change its name to Exxon, they envisioned a completely different transportation option. And if you look at a map of the circumpolar north, you can see marine routes, essentially shortcuts through the Arctic Ocean, whereby Prudhoe Bay is roughly equidistant from Tokyo, London, New York, and shipping oil by tanker is almost always less expensive than by pipeline. And Humble theorized, we can load Prudhoe Bay crude oil right into tankers anchored there in the Beaufort Sea, the Arctic Ocean, and then they can sail via those circumpolar marine routes to Asia, Europe, and the east coast of the United States. Now, just because that's the shortest distance on the map, however, your listeners, I'm sure, will be aware that the circumpolar north is covered by a polar ice pack anywhere from 1 foot to 100 feet thick. And so any tanker, any vessel that was going to sail these circumpolar marine routes was going to have to be an icebreaker, capable of breaking through that ice and withstanding the incredible pounding of the Arctic environment. This leads them then to the SS Manhattan, which was a full-size, real-life experiment just to see if it could be done.
Now, I'm looking at a map that was produced by Humble Oil in 1969 showing exactly what you were describing, essentially looking at the globe from the top. And from there, the Prudhoe Oil is sort of at the center of an imagined transoceanic system of shipping oil. But of course, this proposal and this experiment wasn't the most extraordinary proposal for shipping Prudhoe oil. Could you explain maybe a couple of the other more outlandish proposals for how to get oil out of this region of the Arctic?
Yeah, it was, you know, the discovery of Prudhoe Bay was a real boom for the state of Alaska and for the oil industry. And like resource booms everywhere, regardless of the resource, there's all kinds of dreamers and schemers and people coming up with wild and inventive ideas of how to develop the resource. They toyed for an idea with using blimps to carry the crude oil. Also airplanes. In fact, Boeing and Lockheed independently both came up with schematics for an airplane larger than a Hercules C-130, which was really the workhorse of the industry at that time. They looked at submarines, submarine tankers, and of course the stated advantage of a submarine tanker over a surface tanker like the Manhattan is that a submarine could sail under the pack ice. Largely free of that hostile surface environment. Trains and tanker trucks and aerial tramways. I mean, you name it. If it could be dreamed up, it was explored as a transportation option for crude oil. But you know, the oil industry, like every industry, economics always rule the day. And by the end of it, all of these outlandish schemes were easily dismissed as being wildly expensive.
So let's talk a bit about the Prudhoe Bay discovery for a moment in terms of Alaska's history. How significant was this oil discovery to Alaska history and understanding the course of the history of this state for the remainder of the 20th century?
It's the pivotal event, really, in Alaska's history in the 20th century. Now, Alaska becomes a state in 1959. So at the time of the strike, the state was not even yet a decade old, so the state's political institutions were still very much under development. The state, the largest in the Union by far, only had a population of maybe 300,000 people scattered over this wide area. The state budget, the annual budget of the state, was only something on the order of $150 million for such an enormous territory and a widely scattered population in need of basic resources, you know, roads, bridges, hospitals, schools, that type of thing. And so for that first decade of statehood, Alaska was really in financial dire straits. And in fact, that had been one of the prime arguments against granting Alaska statehood in the 1950s, is that with such a small population, such a minuscule tax base, the state would have difficulty supporting itself economically. And for the first decade of statehood, that was largely true. Now, Prudhoe Bay, 1968, 20 billion barrels of crude oil at $50, $100 a barrel, whatever the fluctuations of oil price might be.
That's a different kind of tax base.
We're talking in a tremendous amount of money here. And that single event really launched, catapulted Alaska from this, you know, financial backwater into a major oil-producing state. Just to give you some idea, in September of 1969, now this is 1 year after the Prudhoe Bay discovery, mm-hmm. the state of Alaska holds a lease sale at Prudhoe Bay in which the state auctions for competitive bid some 500,000 acres to the oil companies for drilling rights. On that single day, the state raised $900 million. Now, that was a figure that eclipsed the state budget that year by a factor of six.
Wow.
It's hard to imagine, really, the tremendous impact that the Prudhoe Bay discovery had on the state. And, of course, by developing this resource, the state was very much aligning its interests with those of the oil industry, for better or for worse, and it set the course of social, economic, political institutions in the state of Alaska to the present day.
And Alaskans at the time were well aware of the historical significance of this discovery then?
Oh, absolutely.
So this gives us maybe a bit of a sense why these oil companies would support such an extraordinary voyage as the Manhattan's 1969 voyage through the Northwest Passage, something which had never been done before by a commercial vessel up to that point.
That's true. Every expedition had been supported by governments or military at that point.
So could you explain for listeners some of the challenges that the crew of the Manhattan faced on this expedition? When did the voyage begin? When did it end? Could you give us some of the details?
Sure. So Humble Oil takes possession of the Manhattan in early 1969. Now, the first challenge that they faced was converting her to an icebreaker. The Manhattan was originally constructed as a conventional tanker vessel, and so they had to convert her into an icebreaker to survive this Arctic voyage. Essentially, they had to pack her hull with 20,000 tons of steel. They built what was called an ice belt. You can think of it sort of as a double hull around the vessel, a 30-foot sheet of high tensile strength steel, an inch and a half thick, capable of withstanding between 300 and 900 pounds per square inch of pressure. They installed this belt, this double hull, all the way around the vessel to protect the hull from the ice. They also installed a revolutionary new design for the bow, an ice-breaking bow that operated by the downward-breaking principle. So what that means, the bow had a very, very sharp curve, enabling the vessel to ride atop the ice layer, bringing to bear the weight of her hull in a downward force onto the ice. Hmm. And this is how an icebreaker works. This is how that weight of that hull cracks and splits those ice flows, creating a pathway for the vessel to move forward. So all of these renovations took place in the first half of 1969, primarily at Sun Shipyards in Chester, Pennsylvania. 10,000 laborers put in 2.5 million man hours on the job. It was the largest shipbuilding operation in the United States since the Second World War. Once they finally have the vessel ready, she's now an icebreaker, they set off in late August 1969, head north to Greenland, turn mm-hmm. left, and go head straight into the Canadian Arctic. Now, this is happening in August and September, which is actually the period of sea ice minimum. Well, now, what that means is that over the long Arctic summer with the midnight sun, temperatures are slightly warmer. You've got the sun beating down on the ice pack mm-hmm. 24 hours a day, and it begins to degrade and weaken that ice. So the Manhattan actually sailed when the Arctic ice was at its weakest. Nevertheless, the captains of the Manhattan, and there were three, they had three captains on her bridge, they took the tanker into the toughest ice conditions that they could find. Mm-hmm. It's counterintuitive because every other icebreaker in the world is looking for the easiest passage through the ice. But because this was a scientific experiment and Humble is trying to gather information and data on these ice layers, they intentionally took the vessel into the toughest conditions that they could find. And they certainly found them. Flows of ice 10, 20, 30 feet thick. And the vessel, in fact, became stuck several times in the Arctic ice layer.
And how did the vessel escape when it got trapped?
Well, one of the drawbacks to the Manhattan was that she had 43,000 horsepower forward, which is incredibly powerful, a very fast vessel. Only about 12,000 horsepower in reverse, however. And of course, at the time that the Manhattan was constructed as a conventional tanker, there'd be no need to achieve great power or speed going backwards. And so the vessels were not optimized for rearward speed. But that's exactly the type of thing that an Arctic icebreaker needs, because you're going forward and you're backing up and you're pounding forward and backing up and building up ahead of steam. So horsepower, both forward and reverse, is required for an Arctic icebreaker, which the Manhattan did not have. Now, fortunately, the Canadian government sent along one of its Coast Guard icebreakers, the John A. McDonald, as an escort vessel. The McDonald is only about 300 feet long, so she's much shorter, a third shorter than the Manhattan, and obviously not as heavy. But the John A. McDonald is actually a more powerful icebreaker relative to her size, because the McDonald did have that forward and rearward horsepower capability. Mm-hmm. So when the Manhattan became stuck, the John A. McDonald would go up the port and then down the starboard and around the vessel, breaking up those ice layers that were holding the Manhattan fast, giving the tanker just enough relief, just enough breathing room to continue forward. The McDonald, in fact, proved indispensable to the voyage.
Why did the McDonald join the Manhattan in the first place?
Well, you can imagine that this expedition set off a not insignificant amount of controversy in Canada. Here you've got an American vessel sailing between two American ports, potentially carrying an environmentally hazardous substance, crude oil. Now, the Manhattan did not carry crude oil. This was only an experiment, so her tanks were filled only with ballast water. So there was really no environmental risk. Mm-hmm. But you imagine that if other tankers would follow in the Manhattan's wake, carrying crude oil, this has great environmental risk for the Canadian archipelago, for the waters that the Canadian government believed were territorial to their nation. Mm-hmm. So this set off a political and a diplomatic controversy. The Canadians asked, you know, a very fundamental question: who owns the Northwest Passage? Now, the position of Ottawa is that these waters of the North American Arctic were internal to Canada. The position of the United States, not surprisingly, was an international waterway where the right of free passage held. So the Canadian government decides to send the John A. McDonald along as an escort vessel, really to sort of wave the flag and demonstrate that these waters were under Canadian jurisdiction. And because the McDonald was so pivotal to the success of the Manhattan, it really bolstered the claim of Canada that these waters were internal. It basically demonstrated that the most powerful ship in the world, the SS Manhattan, could not transit the Northwest Passage unassisted. Therefore, no ship in the world could be expected to transit the Northwest Passage without assistance from Canada. And so the presence of the McDonald and the aid that she gave to the expedition really strengthened Ottawa's claim to functional sovereignty, if not outright sovereignty, of the Northwest Passage.
It's actually kind of an amusing story, too. Ottawa grants permission to an American company to travel the Northwest Passage when the company didn't ask.
Exactly right. The company, Humble Oil, did not ask for permission. The U.S. State Department did not ask for permission to send one of its icebreakers, the Northwind, a U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker, because even to ask the question would be to suggest that there was permission to be given. So no permission was asked. It was there, you know, the United States simply informed Canada, and Canada informed the United States that these vessels were going. It's funny how, you know, diplomacy often hinges on these very semantic distinctions, what words are used and not used.
So Well, could you maybe paint a bit of a picture for readers and listeners what it was like to travel through this ice in places where vessels hadn't made this kind of attempt to break ice at thicknesses never attempted before? How did crews describe it? How did reporters describe it?
Right. Well, you can imagine on the Manhattan the historic significance of the voyage. And so the humble PR department, there were VIPs on the Manhattan. There were a number of newspaper reporters, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Time, Newsweek, international journalists from Japan, Germany, all over. This is a fascinating story, you know, mm-hmm. the commercial vessel to complete the Northwest Passage. So you've got 126 people on a vessel that normally only has about 30 or 40. And these reporters and VIPs and crew members were just walking the decks of the ship, watching this enormous vessel break ice. And the way that they described it was really extraordinary. And in fact, if your listeners go maybe to YouTube, there's a couple of videos of the Manhattan, and you can actually see moving images of the ship. And so the vessel, as she rides atop the ice layer, would break the ice pack, and you would have these enormous blocks of ice, 12 feet thick, turning on their edge, sliding the length of the hull. Sometimes the ice chunks would get trapped underneath the vessel, and they would actually ride the length of the keel before being regurgitated out in her wake to the rear of the vessel. And so the men who are in the engine room, which of course is in the bottom and the rear of the vessel back in the stern, they would hear these blocks of ice scraping and grinding their way along the steel of the hull. And they said it was a surreal experience, almost like you had like the chunks of ice were almost alive. They gave out these very animate shrieks and howls. And then when the ice, those blocks of ice would come out the stern of the vessel, observers who were on the deck looking down could see these sawtooth gouges in the ice where the propellers had taken chunks out of the ice floor. And all of this is happening on almost an unimaginable scale. Blocks of ice, several tons in weight and the size of small houses, in fact. I mean, you can imagine what a spectacle this was to see.
Now, the Manhattan eventually arrives in Alaska. It successfully makes the transit of the Northwest Passage.
That's correct. It took about 3 weeks, and Manhattan comes out into the Beaufort Sea and arrives at Prudhoe Bay in mid-September 1969. To great fanfare, this was a huge celebration. The governor of the state of Alaska was there. Some senators and members of Congress were there. Everyone wanted to be there to be a part of this this incredible achievement. And when the Manhattan arrives, they hold a ceremony called the Golden Barrel Ceremony, where a single drum of oil, a 55-gallon drum, was painted gold for the ceremonial occasion, filled with Prudhoe Bay crude oil. That was the first barrel of oil lifted from the Prudhoe Bay field, which was subsequently then loaded onto the Manhattan and then taken back to the east on her return voyage to New York. That gold barrel, incidentally, today is part of the collection at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C.
So what did the success of this transit of the Northwest Passage ultimately prove then?
Well, a couple of things. So although the Manhattan successfully transited the Northwest Passage, it really demonstrated for the oil industry that this was neither an economic nor a logistically feasible way to transport crude oil. When comparing the Arctic shipping routes to the proposed Trans-Alaska pipeline, it all comes down to dollars and cents. And the oil industry added up what the cost of a pipeline was going to be versus the cost of these ice-breaking tankers. And what Humble Oil realized is that if they were to use the Manhattan as a launching point for this ice-breaking tanker transportation option, they would be building 30 ice-breaking ships that would, in fact, in some cases, twice the size of the SS Manhattan. They would be building an entire fleet of escort vessels, essentially a fleet of John A. McDonald's, to help these tankers through the passage. Mm-hmm. building an offshore oil terminal at Prudhoe Bay to load these tankers. Well, when you start adding these things up, it comes to billions and billions of dollars. And this was at a time when the estimated cost of the Trans-Alaska pipeline was just $900 million. Now, the cost of the pipeline would ultimately escalate, and in fact, the final cost of the pipeline was $8 billion. The industry didn't know that in 1969, 1970. So when they're comparing the costs of these two transportation options, it became pretty obvious that the pipeline was going to have an advantage. This caused Humble, in fact, to cancel the Arctic tanker test, which is why we don't see ice-breaking tankers in the Arctic today. Now, what that really demonstrates, though, is a couple of things. First, the oil industry, in times of discovery, such as at Prudhoe Bay, is given to spending millions of dollars on experiments such as this just to see if it would work out. It's believed that the SS Manhattan expedition cost Exxon somewhere in the range of $50 to $60 million.
Wow.
But when you're Exxon, when you're the largest oil company in the world, you can afford to spend that kind of money testing these types of transportation option. This was really a sort of a wake-up call for the state of Alaska. They realized that they were in the big leagues now, that you have oil companies who are going to spend this kind of money to develop this resource. And this is when you start to see Alaska become more politically mature in terms of their taxation regime, how they interact with the oil industry. Now, that's not to say that the state of Alaska is mature necessarily, because you're still dealing with these multinational companies, very powerful, very adept at these types of negotiations. But the Manhattan, along with the pipeline, along with all of these other things that are happening, is really a turning point for the state of Alaska.
Now, you make the case, too, in the book that the environment of the Arctic plays a pivotal role in influencing the decision that Humble ultimately makes to abandon the icebreaker option for transportation.
That's correct. Right. So the SS Manhattan, although successfully transiting the passage, really proved that it was not an economic way to transport oil. Now, that's in 1969. Today, of course, the situation is much different. And over the next 40 and 50 years, the changing environment of the circumpolar north is going to completely change these questions and the possibilities for this type of transportation method.
Right, and that brings me to a point that you bring up in the epilogue. You write a very startling statement. You say that where 105,000 deadweight ton icebreaker fought through the ice pack in September 1969, a fiberglass sailboat could have made the transit in September 2007. Since this 1969 voyage of the Manhattan through the Northwest Passage, how has the environment of the Arctic changed as a result of global warming? And what do you see as the consequences of this environmental change?
It's really quite extraordinary, the extent to which that polar ice cap is melting. And some computer model projections show a seasonally ice-free Arctic within a decade or two. Now, that's not just an ice-free Northwest Passage. That's an ice-free Arctic. That's an elimination of ice altogether in the August, September, October timeframe, the period of sea ice minimum. If and when that happens, these passages are going to open up, not just the Northwest Passage through the Canadian Arctic, but also the Northeast Passage, the Northern Sea Route, which the Russians, in fact, have been using for decades now. It's going to open up the possibility for transits from the Pacific to the Arctic through the Bering Strait between Russia and Alaska. So, of course, the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese are very interested in the possibility of these marine shortcuts to Europe. All of these things are going to change with the thinning of the Arctic ice pack. Now, it's interesting that in the Northwest Passage, at least, the short-term prospect for shipping may actually become more difficult, because as that ice pack recedes, you're going to end up with larger icebergs and ice flows migrating through the Canadian archipelago, essentially blocking those channels between and around the islands. So the transportation may become more challenging, in fact.
These would be like the icebergs that slammed the Manhattan on its return voyage back to New York in 1969.
That's exactly right. And some of these icebergs are going to outweigh these vessels by a factor of 10. And you can imagine the damage that they would do to vessels in collisions like that. So things are radically changing. But it's really extraordinary. I know people in Nome, Alaska, who have told me that for a few years now, every summer, a sailboat will just turn up. Nobody knew it was coming. Nobody knew it was out there. But all of a sudden, you know, pull into port and announce that it had just made a voyage through the Northwest Passage.
Well, I have to say for listeners, after reading about the 1969 voyage of the Manhattan and how difficult that voyage was and how groundbreaking in terms of the science of icebreaking, it was in the end of the 1960s. It's absolutely staggering to think that such a voyage would be a breeze in the beginning of the 21st century.
It's quite extraordinary. It's estimated that there are as many as 4,000 to 5,000 vessels operating in Arctic waters today. Now, very few, probably none of them, in fact, are making a transcontinental voyage the way the Manhattan did. It's a lot of pleasure craft, a lot of barges going up to supply northern communities and then turning around and going back the same way that it came. But with thousands of vessels operating in the Arctic waters, we are really entering a new era of environmental history in the Arctic.
And this really underlines the point for Canadians. The question about Canadian sovereignty in the Arctic archipelago was complicated in the late 1960s. I can only imagine how much more complicated it is with so many more vessels sailing waters that the Canadian government considers to be internal territorial waters.
That's exactly right. And of course, the United States and Canadian governments to this day agree to disagree on the legal status of the Northwest Passage.
Well, Ross, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there for today, but I want to thank you for letting us know a little bit more about your book, Breaking Ice, the for Arctic Oil, the Epic Voyage of the SS Manhattan Through the Northwest Passage. Listeners should certainly pick up a copy. It's an incredibly engaging read and gives the full story of what was a profoundly significant event in Arctic history. Thank you, Ross.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, the Network in Canadian History and Environment, the Robarts Centre for Canadian Studies, and Canada's History Magazine. This episode was made by Stacey Nation Knapper, Andrew Watson, Jim Dashik, Joshua McFadgen, Dagmar Degroot, Ross Cohen, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate and review this podcast on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you'd like to send me some feedback about this episode, you can contact me through my website, SeanCourage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community in Canada from the Niche website at niche-canada.org, and you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. To keep up with current work in the field of environmental history, I encourage listeners to download our iOS app, which works on iPhone, iPod Touch, and the iPad. You can get the app at niche-canada.org/envhist. That's ENVHIST. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next month with another episode of Nature's Past.